On July 1st, 150 years ago, the largest battle to ever take place in North America began, claiming an estimated 45,000 lives. Battle of Gettysburg was also the turning point of the American Civil War. In his latest book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, Alan C. Gelzo, the director of Civil War era studies at Gettysburg College, offers new insights into the events that occurred and the decisions that led to the bloody battle. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Alan Gelzo to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
It was fought over 3 days, as I said, from July 1st to the 3rd. What was the state of the war before the summer of 1863?
Bad. And in fact, in the 6 months prior to the battle, probably the worst it had been. For 3 summers now, the American Civil War had slogged on, and with comparatively little to show for it except ever-lengthening casualty lists, especially in the Eastern Theater, where the principal Union Army, the Army of the Potomac, had reeled from one defeat after another. Not just defeats, humiliating defeats.
And why is that? Were they just more poorly trained? Did they have worse leadership?
All of these armies were poorly trained. These were all amateur armies. But the Army of the Potomac seemed to have drawn the ticket for some of the worst possible commanders that you could pull out of a hat. And the list of them just was a history of disappointment and failure.
The fighting continued for nearly 2 more years. So why is the Battle of Gettysburg considered the crucial turning point of the war?
Well, 2 reasons, principally. One is that finally the Army of the Potomac wins a big, big battle. And this was a big battle.
With great losses.
It goes over 3 days. It's a tremendous bloodbath. But the Army of the Potomac finally emerges successful. And that cracks the sort of myth of invincibility that had come to settle like a halo around the Confederates.
Why was the battle fought in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania? Was that of strategic importance?
Much more than people thought it was. Gettysburg's right in the middle of the big plain that runs from the Susquehanna River westward to the foothills of the Appalachians. And it's the point where the north-south and east-west roads cross as you're getting from the river to the mountains. Anyone who was going to try to operate in south-central Pennsylvania in 1863, sooner or later, was going to have to come to Gettysburg.
Well, how much of the war was fought in northern states like Pennsylvania?
Not much, because one thing the Union Army does at least manage to do is, even when it loses, to do that losing on southern territory. And that means that while Virginia is defended by the Army of Northern Virginia under Robert E. Lee, defending it simply wears down the economy of Virginia, and that can't go on forever. So it was Lee's conviction that we've got to carry the war northwards, because if we do, not only can we feed the Confederate Army off northern barns and fields, but if we can win a victory on northern territory, that's going to have a colossal whack to northern war morale and maybe bring an end to the war just on those terms.
But they had to go through Maryland, which was a slave state, although it had sided with the North.
Well, Maryland was not hard to get through, especially where they crossed the Potomac, because they did it above Harper's Ferry at one of the narrowest points of the state of Maryland. They crossed at Williamsport and moved immediately to Hagerstown, and then it was just a hop, skip, and a jump up into Pennsylvania.
Is the geography of Gettysburg conducive to a battle of this sort?
You would think not, because most of the geographical lines run as ridges, north-south, and they're not easy to convert into defensive positions, especially for artillery. But there is one piece of geography that's an exception to that, and that's Cemetery Hill, just south of the town. Cemetery Hill is really a broad, flat plateau, and to the eye of a 19th century artilleryman, that was the perfect gun platform. In fact, it was probably the single best piece of military real estate in all of south central Pennsylvania.
It also lends itself to hand-to-hand combat.
Well, actually, what it'll do is it'll make sure that they never even get close enough for hand-to-hand combat. Because
you
can put artillery up there and park it battery to battery, they'll never even get close.
But you do say that the effectiveness of the bayonet was a lot more than people imagine.
Oh, yes. People think that in the 19th century, soldiers, especially Civil War soldiers, were doing something particularly foolish by still fighting in what looked like Napoleonic lines of battle. And didn't the rifled musket render that technologically silly? And the answer is really no. The technology of the time still made the bayonet the decider of battle.
Despite the fact that gun rifling technology was available to both sides?
Yes. You have to understand, though, that rifling, while it improved the accuracy and range of the weapons these soldiers carried, also had its own limitations. It didn't improve it that much. And they were still single-shot black powder weapons that were slow to load and, when they fired, kicked out banks of powder smoke that looked like London fog coming in.
Estimates for the number of casualties range greatly from 43,000 to 51,000. From your research, what do you think is the most accurate figure?
The more research you do, the less sure there is such a thing as an accurate figure. There were no grave registration units. There were no really accurate ways of keeping these kinds of counts. So the best estimates probably place the upper bracket at maybe 9,000 dead from both armies. And maybe the lowest end figure would be 5,000. But it's complicated by the fact that, well, are you counting those who are actually killed right in action, or you're counting someone who dies of wounds 2 or 3 days later? There's no fixed standards, and there's no authority that way. So most of this really has an element of guesstimate to it.
Well, as you said, both armies were largely made up of volunteers whose officers and soldiers had received very little training. Was that one of the factors in why this was such a bloody battle?
It certainly was, because these soldiers, not having anything that we today would compare to boot camp or basic training, were very often flung into action here with only the sketchiest kind of preparation. And for that reason, officers and men alike really don't have the kind of techniques of attack, of combat, that will allow them to come to a decisive action, make a decisive decision. Rather, what they usually do, it degenerates into long-standing firefights that just pile the casualties up until one side or the other finally decides they've had enough.
But the two generals involved, George Meade and Robert E. Lee, they were experienced military men. Shouldn't they have been able to come up with better strategies?
Well, they were experienced, but what were they experienced in? They'd both graduated from West Point, but in their day, West Point was primarily an engineering school. And, in fact, it is still the domain of the Corps of Engineers. What you learned at West Point was not combat operations. It was not strategy. It was not tactics. You learned how to build fortifications. And if you entered into combat at all at any point in your life, it was usually with the Comanches or the Apaches.
My guest is Alan C. Guelzo, G-U-E-L-Z-O. His book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. There are a lot of non-combat duties that need to be performed for an army to function properly, such as cooking and laundry. In the U.S. Army, those tasks were performed by paid civilian employees. Was it the same for the Confederacy?
No, and hereby hangs a tale. The Army of Northern Virginia comes up from the South with about 85,000 men, we would estimate. The Union Army numbers about 95,000. And people scratch their heads and say, well, that sounds foolish. Here's the Confederate Army going on the offensive when it's actually outnumbered. What people don't see is that in the Union Army, all of those logistical tasks were either going to be performed by paid contractors or, more often, by enlisted personnel. In the Confederate Army, there is a shadow corps, so to speak, and that is composed of black slaves.
So 10,000 at least?
The estimates, because here no one was keeping any kind of roll, the estimates run between 10 and 30,000.
Wow.
So that is what you have to add as the logistical tail to the Confederate Army.
And then there were free African Americans in the North. What happened when the Confederate Army came upon them?
Those who had not already decamped and fled to safer quarters were quite frequently rounded up by Confederates invading Pennsylvania, roped together, ironed together, and sent off to the Richmond slave markets to be sold into slavery. That was whether they might have been fugitives from before the war or whether their families had been free families for generations before. It made no difference. They would be seized by the Confederates and sent south for auction.
Now, this area was populated. Did everybody just flee?
Most of them did. The roads to the north and to the east were choked with wagons, buggies, refugees, on foot, on horseback. It was a real Independence Day kind of scenario, with people fleeing for dear life and for dear property from the advancing Confederates.
Although we're not going to go into the story. You tell the story of John Burns, a veteran of the War of 1812 who insisted on participating, and there was a kind of a gentlemanly side to the end of that story.
Well, only in the sense that John Burns talked his way out of what could have been a very lethal position. He had shown up on the first day of the battle with his old swallowtail coat and a rifle, and he wanted to take pot shots at the Confederates. And he did. Unfortunately, the Confederates shot back. He was wounded three times. They captured him. And when they did, he said, well, I'm just an old farmer. I was out here looking for my cow, and I got caught in this. And the Confederates very reverently picked him up in a stretcher and carried him back to his house, when otherwise they probably could have put him up against a barn wall and shot him.
What did people think they were fighting for? Did the people in the Southern soldiers, many of whom were not slave owners, think they were fighting to preserve slavery, or were they fighting for the states' rights? What about the ones in the North? Wasn't the brother-in-law of General George Meade a governor in the South?
George Gordon Meade's brother-in-law was Henry Wise, governor of Virginia, and in fact a Confederate general as well. His nephew, Meade's nephew, had been killed on the other side in the Confederate Army at the Battle of Chancellorsville. So the connections on both sides here can be very close. Why did they fight? In large measure, it all comes down to slavery. I know that for some people that's still, after all these years, a difficult thing to admit, but when you come right down to it, even when they're talking about states' rights, they're talking about, on the Confederate side, they're really talking about slavery.
But wasn't Robert E. Lee kind of ambivalent about slavery? And he did have, his whole history was kind of connected to the Union. He, as we said, he went to West Point. He was the son of an American Revolutionary War hero, Light Horse Harry Lee.
Everybody in the South professed to be ambivalent about slavery and then proceeded to do nothing about their ambivalence, the best example being Thomas Jefferson.
Now, there are many commonly held beliefs about the Battle of Gettysburg that you describe as myths. Perhaps the most prominent is that General Lee suffered a lack of intelligence as a result of the absence of his cavalry commander, Jeb Stuart.
The problem with that myth is not that Jeb Stuart had gone galloping off on his own private joyride. He had. The problem with that myth is that cavalry did not provide intelligence services to the armies. Cavalry in the American Civil War plays very limited functions. It provides screening, it provides raiding, but it does not do intelligence. Lee was obtaining intelligence of Union Army movements from spies, from scouts, not cavalry. Above all, he was provided with intelligence by reading Northern newspapers. Wherever he went, he wanted to see the newest Northern newspapers because the Northern newspapers obligingly provided news of all the movements of the Union Army.
So this leads us to another myth. Some believe that the Battle of Gettysburg happened by chance. The two armies were unaware of each other's positions and blundered into each other.
No. Robert E. Lee fully expected that he would fight a battle. If he was going to fight a battle at all in this campaign, it would be fought, and he put his finger down on the map and he said it'll be fought either at Frederick City or at Gettysburg. He frequently referred to Gettysburg as the place where he expected to encounter the Union Army. And elements of the Union Army also wanted to fight Lee at Gettysburg.
There are a lot of famous people present at the battle. George Custer, of Custer's Last Stand fame. Abner Doubleday, the man who probably didn't invent baseball, but was given credit for it. And a really interesting character, Daniel E. Sickles, who had shot and killed his wife's lover before the war. And the lover was the son of Francis Scott Keyes.
That's right. He's New York's finest, so to speak. He was maybe the strangest, the most peculiar person in this whole story of Gettysburg. Before the war in 1859, he had, in fact, shot to death Philip Barton Key, who had been philandering with Sickles' wife, and then gets off the murder rap by the plea of temporary insanity.
First person to ever
get off on that. And his lawyer, his lead lawyer, was Edwin M. Stanton.
After the defeat of the Confederate Army, General Meade allowed General Lee and the remnants of his rebel army to escape back south. Do you think that that was a major mistake?
I think it was. Meade was a cautious general by nature, and he had only been put in command of the army 3 days before the battle began, and the Army of the Potomac had taken something of a shellacking during those 3 days. So you can cut George Meade certainly some slack on those points. And yet, overwhelmingly, the opinion in the Army was that Meade was just too cautious, too slow, too hesitant, and too unwilling to push this to the point where he might risk his reputation. He'd now won a victory. He was going to try and hug that victory close.
The North won another victory at the same time at Vicksburg.
That's right.
Was that any less important to the Northern cause than the victory at Gettysburg?
Getting both of those victories on the same weekend gave Abraham Lincoln and the North the best weekend they'd had during the war. But Vicksburg actually sits somewhere below Gettysburg in importance simply because the fall of Vicksburg opens up the Mississippi River Valley. That's a great political accomplishment, but it's not a great military one. Gettysburg is a great military accomplishment.
You're a professor at Gettysburg College and live in the town. Has living in the battlefield given you a better understanding of the events that took place 150 years ago?
I think it has, because it gives you a familiarity for the ebb and flow of the land, the terrain, the relationships of place to place, what the soldiers themselves were able to see in the midst of this fighting.
Alan C. Gelzo is the Henry R. Luce Professor of the Civil War Era and Director of Civil War Era Studies at Gettysburg College, author of a number of books. The most recent, the one we've been discussing, is Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. It is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Very fine to be here. Thank you.